in our second hour.
So let's go right to that interview. Norman Solomon, Reese Ehrlich were in our studios just about last Friday, I think. Here's that interview.
As we continue to listen to the drum beats of war more and more, I think a lot of people, including a lot of the listeners to this station, are feeling like they need some help in decoding what the mainstream media is trying to tell them. It's pretty clear that the mainstream media is sort of doing cattle journalism at this point, if I could use that term, all sort of going along on the same pack and drum beating as much as our politicians are. So we're really lucky and fortunate to have here in the Bay Area and joining us today in the studio, two people who can decode and let us know what is really going on. Reese Ehrlich and Norman Solomon are, I think, two of the greatest names in media analysis right now, especially for those of us who consider ourselves to be progressive. They have put together a new book entitled Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And again, it's by Norman Solomon, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and well-known syndicating columnist, and also Reese Ehrlich, foreign correspondent, it says here. He's also an award-winning producer of The Russia Project, a radio program hosted by Walter Cronkite. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here. And I'm so glad. It's very interesting that as we're doing this interview, we sort of can see in the distance the CNN showdown with Iraq headlines telling us about, oh, the orange alert and how aggravated the troops are getting because they're ready to start war and we're just not ready to get them going. So let me just start with you, Norman, and maybe you could tell us what you're feeling as we're seemingly getting closer to the war of what the media is doing.
Well, you refer to cattle journalism, and it's really, I think, an apt phrase. You know, the push is to be ahead of the pack, but not out of step. And I found from three visits now to Baghdad since last September that a lot of the U.S. journalists there, hardworking, adverse conditions, frustrated because a lot of their feeds and stories have to go through the meat grinder back home, and pretty soon they got to internalize what the spin is from the punditocracy back home, and that really damages the kind of stories and coverage we ultimately get back here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Reese, same question to you.
Well, I think it's the starting point is that Washington is where the story is at, not Iraq, as far as most American reporters are concerned. That is, you can go to Iraq, you can find interesting things, you can find interesting stories, but everything has to come back to what does Washington say. And my favorite one is, no matter how bold-faced the lies are, you have to treat them with a straight face. So allow me for a moment to quote from the New York Times of February 12th of this year, in which the U.S. has admitted that it plans currently to invade and occupy Iraq for 2 years and place General Tommy Franks in charge of the country, which is a benevolent a way of running the country. I suppose most objective observers would call that a military dictatorship. Uh-huh. Now, here, those are the facts. Now, this is quoted now from an administration source who says, quote, "We will demonstrate to the Iraqi people and the world that the United States wants to liberate, not occupy or control their economic resources." And that's treated straight-faced. Hello? The U.S. invades, occupies a country, takes over its oil fields, and then you quote something like that without any derision, scorn, or criticism. Hey, that's not journalism. That's stenography for those in power.
Well, this reminds me so much of General MacArthur in 1945 taking over Japan. And allegedly, MacArthur's administration of Japan was benevolent, and the Japanese, of course, ultimately prospered and became well off. So the other thing that has occurred is the question of, well, who's going to pay for this war, given that the last war was paid for by the Saudis and others. This time it's being alleged that maybe the U.S. will just take over the Iraqi oil fields, and that's how this war will be paid for. But that might feed into the notion that the purpose of U.S. going to war was to take the oil away from Iraq in the first place, and we don't want to feed into that.
Yeah, first, just a quick comment on the analogy to Japan or Germany after the war. Obviously, the situations are entirely different because Japan had been a imperial power conquering much of Asia, as had Germany and Europe. And the question, theoretically, in Germany, it was a joint occupation of a aggressive imperial power, very different from the U.S. plans for Iraq to basically go it alone. But on the issue of who pays for it, yeah, that's the other question that is either not asked by the media or whispered, shall we say. And that's because the answer is so embarrassing and so disastrous for the administration. Estimates by the administration, by the way, range from $100 billion to $200 billion at a time when we're already running a record deficit for this kind of an economy. And it's so bad that when the Bush administration put forward its new budget, it didn't even include the cost for the war because they say we can't, well, we can't tell, so we can't include it. So the bill comes later. It's roughly like me saying, well, I think I'll buy 3 new houses. I don't know how much they'll cost, but we'll take care of the mortgages later. It don't work that way. And, of course, one of the reasons the media does that is because leading top-level Democrats aren't criticizing, are not holding Bush's feet to the fire on this. So the media doesn't raise it on their own either, and so therefore the question's not answered. On the issue that you raised about paying, taking over the oil fields to pay for it, yeah, I mean, that is what colonial powers have done for centuries. You know, the British go into India and take over the country and then force the people there, the resources, to go to British companies. Well, when the U.S. goes into Iraq, who is going to get the contracts to rebuild the oil wells and the pipelines and so on? Halliburton. And it's pure coincidence that Halliburton used to be headed up by Dick Cheney. I want to emphasize that it's pure coincidence.
Pure coincidence.
You know, back in December, one of the very poignant moments for me was I was traveling around Baghdad with some UNICEF officials and with Sean Penn and some Iraqi officials, and we were having lunch, and other folks drifted off, and I was sitting with the driver, who is Iraqi, and it was very quiet. It was a beautiful day. It was hard to imagine just a few hundred feet from the Tigris River that the missiles would be coming in, perhaps in a matter of a couple of months. And he paused, and in his broken English, he said, "Petrol. If no petrol, no problems." And it's very painful to see the realization. It reminds me of back the story of soon after Columbus arrived in North America, the Arawak Indians on the island taking the gold and throwing it in the ocean in hopes that that would get these Europeans out of there.
Beck, go take a swim. Go get it there. Well, Norman Solomon, you just brought up what I wanted to ask you next, which is you have traveled to Baghdad. You've taken at least two different trips there and gone with Sean Penn, which we can ask you more about. But I think that that's one of the things, again, very much missing from the mainstream media is any sense of who the people of Iraq are. All we seem to hear about is this demon figure of Saddam Hussein and the attempt to put the, as one guest said to us, the beard of Osama bin Laden, attach that onto him. So can you give us more of what you experienced being there and talking to the people who are parents, sons, daughters, human beings just like the rest of us?
Yeah, well, Reese has written some chapters based on his travel in different parts of Iraq. My visits were pretty much confined to Baghdad. And so in late January, for instance, just a few weeks ago, when I went with the former UN official Dennis Halliday, we went to the souk, to the market in Baghdad. It was on a Friday. And we wandered around and talked to people with no minders. We just went by ourselves. And they were folks who Dennis had met when he was stationed there in the late 90s, rug sellers, for instance, merchants. And it was very painful in the quiet moments to hear them ask us, what do you think the chances are of the missiles coming? I mean, people are used to the adversity, the 12 years of sanctions, the previous war. But there was a very a painful moment that I described early on in the book where I was at a water treatment plant, this was back in December, that had been bombed by the U.S. in 1991 and still very damaged. And we had a guide, an Iraqi woman, who talked very almost matter-of-factly about the technical matters of how the water treatment is still damaged there. And then an American young woman who was with us said, "You're strong," you know, as if to comfort the Iraqi woman. And the reply was, "No, not strong." And her eyes began to tear. And then she said, we're tired. And we have this sense as Americans that perhaps people are so accustomed to the adversity, to the bombs, to the sanctions, to the threat of more bombs, that they can hold up. And the empirical data and the anecdotal information as well says they're worn down, and this next war will be much more difficult to endure.
Can I ask you, Risa, a comment about your travels in Iraq?
Sure. Probably the most interesting interchange I had with Iraqis was, again, away from the government minders, who as a reporter are assigned to you and follow you everywhere. But one night we were able to get away, visit the home of our taxi driver outside of Baghdad, and had a conversation with a large number of people. And basically what they said was they don't like Saddam Hussein. He led them into two disastrous wars, one against Iran, one in Kuwait. The sanctions have taken their toll on the economy. And these people, several of them were quite educated, and they're basically running small businesses because that's all they can do. But they said, as bad as Saddam Hussein is, we don't want the U.S. coming in and telling us who our new government is going to be. And he started going through the lists of names of people who were the exiled leaders at that time that were being floated. And he says, who are these people? They don't have any political base here. We only know one name, and that's from BBC and Voice of America. So all these exiled leaders that the U.S. is promoting are not known there, don't have a political base. And so therefore, that's why the U.S. is coming up with this alternative of imposing a U.S. military dictator on the country for however long it takes. So the Iraqis are very much worried about substituting a anti-U.S. repressive dictator with a pro-U.S. repressive dictator. They don't want that.
Well, I think all of us can agree that Saddam Hussein is a horrible person. He was horrible back when he was a big ally of the United States during the Iran-Iraq War, when he used poison gas on the Iranians primarily, but the story about him gassing his own people, of course. United States, when he was our ally, didn't care, didn't give a bleep about that.
They provided him with some of the weapons of mass destruction.
Right, provided him with the poison gas, etc. Given that, so many American people are convinced by the logic, if you want to call it that, of George W. Bush, that this guy's got to go. And the only way he apparently will go is by being overthrown militarily. So that is very convincing to a lot of people.
Well, we deconstruct a lot of the arguments. For instance, there are many regimes that torture their citizens. Some of them get huge aid from the United States, like Egypt, billions a year. Certainly that's not a media issue here. So, you know, it would be logical if your government is against torture, they would stop paying for it as a first step before sending missiles in to another country. There's also the fact about the UN resolutions. We talk in the book about the fact that there are about 100 UN Security Council resolutions currently longstanding and currently being violated by various countries, Turkey, Israel, Morocco, Indonesia. You don't hear about those in the media. You hear about the U.S. is going to enforce the 16 or so resolutions that Iraq has been violating. Well, if you take that standard, then what's to stop any country in the world from bombing Turkey or Morocco or Israel or whatever on the basis that they are enforcing these other U.N. Security Council resolutions? Mm-hmm. You strip it away, and it's really about might makes right. And if we're going to have a foreign policy based on that, let's call it what it is.
You just heard from Norman Solomon, public, well-known media analyst and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Also joining us here in the studio, Reese Ehrlich, foreign correspondent. I love that sort of wide-open title, Reese. And he's also a producer and also a well-known writer. And we're talking about the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And it also includes an introduction by Howard Zinn and an afterword by Sean Penn. And I do want to ask you, Reese, or Norman, both of you, I need some help with why the American public seemingly is so convinced and unable to sort of look beneath what the mainstream media spoons out to them. I find this to be very puzzling because I don't think our population is stupid, and I don't think that they, on some level, don't question some of what's being told to them, but you just don't hear many of those voices. How is this happening? Is it such corporate control that they can't think beyond what's being presented to them? I don't know. Norman, Reese, whoever.
Yeah, no, I think, first of all, there is tremendous anti-war sentiment in this country, mm-hmm. bubbling up
Absolutely.
From below. And I visited Klamath Falls, Oregon, small town, 25,000 people, very conservative community. Last January, during the big anti-war demonstrations here and other places, 300 people showed up in Klamath Falls. Now, that's unprecedented, even in the period of the Vietnam War, when, the of course, the anti-war movement was much bigger. So they're in towns like this across the country. There is, and what's interesting to me is that the even according to the official polls, the amount of support for Bush's attack on Iraq is declining. Mm-hmm. It's not going up. That's the significant part. Now, according to the polls, a majority of people still support Bush. And, of course, if the U.S. actually launches military action against Iraq, the polls will show a huge number of people supporting the action, because they always do. And Bush has been able to manipulate public opinion, the media, Congress, because he's successfully linked people's abhorrence about what happened about 9/11 with Iraq, even though they have absolutely nothing to do with each other. He's managed to combine the war on terrorism with Iraq, even though they have nothing to do with each other. And people are temporarily fooled. I mean, I think that's what it comes down to. And you have to remember, a majority of people in the United States supported the Vietnam War right up to around 68, 69, something like that. Well, you know, 7-8 years into the war, and the number of people opposing this war is far higher, for given the period that we're in, than even in the era of Vietnam.
Is that part of it, Norman, that basically there are people who really get that something's fishy here in the mainstream, but we're just not hearing about them?
Well, you know, the essence of propaganda is repetition, and what the messages are again and again will dominate from a propaganda standpoint. There is, I think, a very key factor, as Reese mentioned, the spinning of 9/11, which has been ongoing, which has been focused by the Bush administration and a lot of their acolytes and allies in the media to at least tacitly accept this idea that there's some connection. And that has been taken by the administration as basically a license to kill, that 9/11 means that whatever they want to do in the name of so-called preemption, they can go ahead and do. The liberal response, if I might say, use that term, Democratic Party response, and people like Nancy Pelosi, who talk brave one day and then buckle. Maybe we're not going it alone. Maybe that's okay. A good comparison is the British press, where we have the Guardian newspaper, we have the Independent, we have the Observer. Because of the coverage in Britain, which is not painting the window on the world red, white, and blue, you have a vast majority of the population opposed to war, and I think that's very significant.
Well, something else, I go through the different NPR programs, I go through the CNN programs, the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, all of his stuff, which makes me want to commit suicide. There's lots of options here. But in any case, one guy I found fascinating, the interviewer was saying something to the effect, well, is the Bush administration really committed to fostering democracy throughout the Middle East, given that all of these Arab countries are largely dictatorships? And then the pundit said, well, there is a problem with democracy. The problem is in many of these countries, the opposition is made up of Muslim fundamentalists. So if in fact you had a democracy in Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, the dictator, if you will, of Egypt, might be overthrown by Muslim fundamentalists.
Yeah, the great scholar Iqbal Ahmed made the point many years ago that the repression supported by the U.S. in many Middle Eastern countries drove political resistance into the mosque, and that's where it has grown.
Well, the problem I have with that is if you're in favor, I mean, there is, this is a fig leaf, this thing about democracy. That they're not in favor of democracy, or are they?
Oh, no, I mean, you know, Mubarak's son is next in line. I mean, you know, if you're with us, then it's okay, whether you're an autocrat, a tyrant, or whatever. And that's empirically on the record in terms of what nations are taken to be U.S. allies, quote unquote, when the repression is standard in those countries.
All you need to do is look at what the U.S. has done in Afghanistan, right? We were going to overthrow the Taliban and restore democracy to Afghanistan, and you've got Hamid Karzai as the president of Kabul, a bunch of warlords pushing drugs and no security, and the U.S. troops are under fire once again. No democracy, no stability.
Norman Solomon, I wanted to take a chance to ask you about the trip that you took to Baghdad with Sean Penn, because that got a lot of attention, a lot of people saying, what's up with that? Why Sean Penn? He's an actor, you know. So can you, and I know you've written about this as well, why did you think that it was an important thing to do, to travel to Baghdad? And I know you did another one with Congress people and such people as Dennis Halliday as well, so it's not just that you're like, let's take celebrities over to Baghdad, but explain these trips.
Yeah, well, most people who object now to actors being involved in politics voted for Reagan. So that tells you something. But it also, I think, is a code in the context of the current battles over war and peace, and that is people should just pipe down and go along with the war program. As the writer Paul Loeb has said, there's always an excuse. You know, if you're too young, you don't know anything. If you're too old, you're nostalgic for the 60s. If you're a professor, you're just an egghead. If you're a religious person, you're unrealistic. And if you're an actor, then you must be an airhead. Well, you know, people in the arts and so forth are like people in any other realm of life. They run the gamut. And the question is whether people are going to exercise their conscience. I was very impressed, having met Sean Penn right before the visit. He had written an open letter to George Bush that was in the Washington Post as a full-page ad in October. And it was because of that letter that the Institute for Public Accuracy invited to accompany him to Baghdad. He immediately accepted, and we went. And his real emphasis is about conscience. On the last full day we were there, I sat in the breakfast area of the hotel and watched him write out the statement that is part of the afterword to this book. He read it to a very full news conference that day in Baghdad. He said, "Simply put, if there is a war or continued sanctions against Iraq, the blood of Americans and Iraqis alike will be on our hands." And his emphasis was, I want to see people. I don't want to stay home and take this in as a made-for-TV movie, watch the pixels of a war being rendered as some kind of video game. I want to get out from behind the media screen, look people in the face, smell the smells, hear the sounds, make that connection, and come home so that the blood on our hands as Americans won't be invisible to us and to others. And I think that both elicited the enormous support that Sean Penn got from his visit, and also a lot of the hostility.
And there was a lot of press ink that seemed to be pretty hostile towards about the whole trip. So.
I'm curious just about one thing. What reaction did the Iraqi people have to Sean Penn? Did they recognize him? What was the reaction?
Most of the reaction, like, for instance, without a minder, he went out with a camera in Saddam City, the Shiite ghetto area of Baghdad, and he was surrounded by hundreds of kids and others, not because he was Sean Penn, but because he was an evident American with a camera. But I did walk with him in the hotel and elsewhere where a number of people came up to him and said, I saw you in this movie or that movie, and it was very moving to me. And I asked, what movies are you referring to? And names like Casualties of War, like Dead Man Walking came up. And it really was an example of how artistic creation can transcend all of the national and political boundaries that we hear so much about.
Rhys Ehrlich, I wanted to ask you to talk about your chapter on depleted uranium, because, again, I think that's an untold story, and we don't quite understand how that fits with us and the dangers therein. So give us a sketch of that.
Sure. The U.S. and Britain use depleted uranium in ammunition fired in machine guns and in tank shells. The depleted uranium is the material that's left over after a nuclear reaction to make plutonium, whether through for nuclear bombs or in power plants. In the United States, it's radioactive nuclear waste that has to be encased and buried or whatever. However, the military some years ago figured out that this stuff is about 1.7 times heavier than lead. It will cut through enemy armor. It's a very protective shield when you put it inside your own tanks. So they used it extensively in the Gulf War and then also in Bosnia, Kosovo, and they're likely to use it again. There's only one small problem with it. When it's fired and hits a hard target, the rounds explode. They create a radioactive fireball, a small one. The dust pulverizes. It gets into the air and spreads for miles. It gets into the soil, can seep into the water table, and basically for years, decades, indeed up to 4.5 billion years afterwards, it remains radioactive as well as a toxic metal. So the result in southern Iraq, in the Basra area, there is a fourfold increase in birth defects and in childhood cancers that the Iraqi doctors have documented. They say it's caused by this use of depleted uranium. The U.S., of course, claims that, no, it's not radioactive, it's safe, you don't have anything to worry about, it doesn't disperse that far, and so on and so forth. And I've interviewed scientists and U.S. officials on this issue. Interestingly enough, there's a guy named Major Doug Rocky, who was the military officer in charge of cleaning up American tanks that had been hit accidentally with DE ammunition. This is the victims of friendly fire. And he has documented that his crew who worked on that, some of them got cancer within 9 months. Others have got cancer shortly afterwards. And they're the same kind of cancers that affect the kids in southern Iraq. And if that's not enough, I went to Bosnia. I went to former Yugoslavia, interviewed Bosnian doctors. And they're now, 8 years after the Bosnian War, starting to see some of the same kind of cancers develop in children and people there. So it's a far more serious problem than the U.S. ever wants to admit. And some people think it could be one of the causes of Gulf War syndrome, or certainly a cause, one cause of problems for our own soldiers. It's a very serious problem that the U.S. basically wants to ignore.
Well, it's what I understand about it from my old physics class was that because it's releasing alpha particles, it's not a problem if it's superficial, if it's just on your skin, that the alpha particles don't go through your skin. It's when you inhale it and you get it in your lungs. And because, as you say, when it's pulverized, it forms this fine dust. If you inhale it, that's where the cancer comes from.
That's exactly right. It's not. That's why the troops who handle the shells themselves, loading them into a tank, for example, or into a machine gun,
they're not
affected. You don't get sick from that. It's after it hits, explodes,
the powder,
and the powder disperses.
Then
that's when you have serious problems, both from radiation.
When you inhale it, yeah.
And also, it's a heavy metal. It's a toxic heavy metal. So, especially when it gets into the water. That the suspicion is that that's another cause.
So
of
drinking it too.
Yeah, eating food that's been raised in the soil where it's been dispersed.
Right. Well, back to what this administration really has in mind. One of the so-called deep thinkers there is Paul Wolfowitz, and I gather he was very much involved in the first Gulf War and very disappointed that the first Gulf War, the U.S. military didn't make it all the way to Baghdad. But what he is talking about is reshaping the entire Middle East and reconstituting not just Iraq, but all of the oil-rich countries, reconstituting, maybe, Norman, you could explain to me, what is the fantasy of Paul Wolfowitz and how likely is that to come into fruition?
Well, if it's not stopped, I think we're on that bloody road. It makes you wonder how much we've advanced in terms of being civilized when you look at, eight decades plus after, the British and other powers carved up the Middle East, made the map on a table by their own whims and priorities. Here we are again. And I'm afraid as well that it could dovetail with just the ethnic cleansing process already well underway because of Israel. The greater Israel fantasies that could be made reality through the military political alliance between the U.S., Israel, and Turkey, etc. So I think it's very real, and we have to take it seriously. What seemed preposterous last summer, a U.S. all-out attack on Iraq, now is upon us, it seems, and these other plans seem to be in the wind as well.
I want to ask both of you to take about 30 or so seconds to talk to people out there listening who think that they are up with the news media. They read the paper every day, and they think that they've got the picture of what's going on. What would you say to them in terms of what they need to do to maybe go a little deeper, to do their own sort of analysis of what really is being said to them? Reese?
I think people have to read as many different sources as possible, read between the lines of the major media, but consult the internet, get on some of these email lists, truthout.com, alternet.org, znet.org. There's a whole bunch of folks out there that are culling foreign press and domestic press to find articles revealing information. The hardest part is not how you interpret what's going on. The hardest part is finding accurate information that doesn't get reported or gets distorted in the mainstream press.
Norman?
The extent of deception is so massive, and there are so many different layers. Just to deconstruct documents like speeches or a UN resolution is crucial. The daily onslaught of media information, disinformation, what Paul Krasner's called disinfotainment at times when it's dramatized. And there's also the psychological level. We're being numbed. We're being anesthetized to distance from the reality that in our names, with our tax dollars, people are being slaughtered. And if we are numbed, then we are not going to be able to take sufficient action.
In the list of websites and alternative media KPFA, it goes without saying, is a key source. I know when the war breaks out, I'm going to be two things. I'm going to turn on the TV to CNN and turn on the radio to KPFA.
Okay. Well, thank you both, Norman Solomon and Reese Ehrlich. We really appreciate and value so much the work that you do, and it is so much a part of what we feel a part of here at KPFA. Again, the book we've been talking about is Target, Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And many, many thanks to Norman and Reese for being here. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.